This is a Pinball News production.
Why don't we start off with, let's let everybody introduce themselves here. We have an extra mic on the stage, so why don't we go ahead and do that. I'm going to jump down here. I'm going to do this a little like not Monty Hall, but I'm going to be down here and all over the place. So let's start off with Larry.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for coming. I'm Larry Zartarian, the president of the, and on the board of directors of the Pacific Pinball Museum in Alameda, California.
Ashbury Park.
Yeah, I'm Michael Sheese, the founder and executive director of the Pacific Pinball Museum.
I'm Jim Sullivan with the Silver Ball Museum. I'm like the head tech, 41 years of pinball experience repairing the machines, keep the place running.
I'm Rob Alvento. I guess I'm the founder of the Silver Ball Museum. Jim, thank God, is the tech that we need, plus the rest of the crew, because anyone who's interested in opening a pinball museum has to understand it's all about gameplay, and you need the technical knowledge, and it's all about keeping the games playing, and that's the most important thing I think you're going to get out of this tonight.
Hi, I'm Charlie Martin, and my wife and I started the Seattle Pinball Museum in August of 2010, and we are extremely pleased to be sitting amongst such greats in the industry.
And I'm Cindy Martin, Seattle Pinball Museum.
Hi, and I'm Clay Harrell. I do have the crappiest mic in the room. Hi, I'm Clay.
It's just me.
Hi, I'm Clay Harrell. I do the Ann Arbor Pinball Museum in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
And I'm Dave Fix. I've been helping with Pinball Expo. I am also works for Dave & Buster's. Give a little history. I do arcade repairs on the side, but I also work for Dave & Buster's full-time. So we're going to get into our panel and discussion. I have a few questions I want to hit, and then we're going to open it up to the floor to get a little bit more history about why a pinball museum and why not an arcade. So let's start off right with Charlie and Cindy. Why don't we want to ask you guys, I know I'm killing you here, right, Charlie? Why did you guys go with a museum instead of an arcade?
Well, that's a pretty good question, and you cheated because you were supposed to let us know what we're going to talk about here. A pinball museum, we chose that format because it's really more than just a game. It's like an experience and a way to see how people have developed and progressed and enjoy these machines over, you know, since the late 1800s when the Bagatelle game came from France. So the way we present our machines is in chronological order with some cards on top of the machines that I stole the idea from this guy right here. Thank you very much, Rob. And
you know he's from New Jersey. They know how to take care of people.
Yeah, I know. I got steel kneecaps, so it's okay. But it's really important to us that people see that this is something that people took a lot of thought and pleasure in developing over the years. And that's why we have them arranged like that, so people can see. In 1963, you were lucky if you got 1,200 points on a five-ball game. 2014, you get 5 million to plunge the ball. I mean, you know, what's that all about? So that's our format, and we really like to be able to present that to people and walk them through and go, look over here. Here's multi-ball in, 1972, you know, for fireball. And look over here. Here's when we changed over from electromechanical. So it's more about just, if you had an arcade, you wouldn't have the games arranged in chronological order. You just have a bunch of games put in there and the way you thought people would fill them up with quarters. But for us, it's all about getting the experience of the progression of the game, where it was, where it's at, and where it's going to. And we'll probably take a little grief from the purists, but we actually now have a virtual pinball machine because that's a branch on the arm of the pinball tree.
Okay. All right, let's go to New Jersey and find out why you more like the museum aspect instead of a traditional arcade.
Well, I saw it similar. I thought there was an opportunity to archive that era of Americana. The way the art works, you know, if you look at the games from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, I have a juggle ball in my home, which is one of the David Roccola's first games. And David Roccola was friends with Pablo Picasso. And if you look at the artwork on that game from 1933, you can see that it was very modern for the time. So if you take that game with Baffle Ball and move forward, we tried to show the evolution as well from 1933 all the way to, you know, 2012, whatever the latest Stern game in, or the, we got the Oz game in last year, because Pinball Jack is about 15 miles away from us. So we tried to archive that whole era and show the progress of pinball. I'm an EM collector. You know, I was a collector before I did a museum, but after you have so many games in your garage and in your living room and at your friend's house and in the basement and in the store, so I said, why don't we put it up and let the public play? And we have some of the rarest EM games. You know, we let people play EM Evel Knievel, EM Mata Hari, TKOs. So they're all up to be played. And I hope that they all play the dot matrix games, because they'll get less wear and tear on the EM games. And I think that was the way we tried to play it out. And then, you know, Jim will talk next to me. You know, I tried to get the best talent in the state of New Jersey to make sure that the games are played. And we're fortunate enough that everything can go back into the museum on our side, so that's what we do. And you know, the collection's up to 600 games. There's 200 in Asbury, and if you silverballmuseum.com, if you do anything, a website's important, your Facebook's important, you know, marketing, running as a business, you know, you have to be able to pay the rents. If you're on the boardwalk in Asbury Park, you're paying a lot of rent. They don't care if it's a pinball museum, the pizzeria next to us that now we took over, you know, can do a lot of volume, but we're open year-round, and I think we're open every day but two during the year.
You gave a good answer here that I want to just go back to Charlie real quick. So how many pins do you have in your collection?
About 600 total, but we rotate. The top 200 are in usually, and it's pretty static now. It's a tough, you can't even get in the lineup. I mean, maybe if I get the Big Bang Bar here, we can make room for that, but most of the games, you're not going to knock out a lot of them, because we tried to put the top game of each era or each year. So that's what I tried to do there. So the top game from 73, 74, 75, all the way up. So we tried to show that evolution.
Okay.
And I think we did a great job of it, but we need more space. We're in about 5,000 square feet, and we're looking to buy the pavilion north of us that has potential for 17,000 square feet.
That'd be good. Charlie, let's just go back to Charlie real quick. How many do you have in your collection?
Currently, I believe we have about 52 pinball machines going from 1963 all the way up to 2015 with our VP pin that's running Pinball FX2. Right next to that is a Star Trek.
Okay.
And we also are dabbling a little bit in arcades, classic titles like Galaga and Missile Command and Asteroids, and now my sickness has progressed a little bit more to start delving into electromechanical arcades. So, you know, they're part of that arcade experience, and it's not really pinball, but, you know, a lot of pinball people really like old, cool arcade games, too, because it takes them right back to when they had that first epiphany in an arcade. It's like, this is where I want to spend my spare time.
Okay, let's go back down to Larry and Michael and ask how many are in their collection. Cindy, I think you have a problem. If you only have 52, I think Charlie's going to be trying to talk to you into going into triple digits here shortly. So,
I think currently we display over 100 at the museum, and I think we have over 900 in the collection.
Very
of
good.
About which maybe half of them are restored.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Very good. Clay, how many do you have in your in out there?
I've got about 300 games. The museum itself has right now 220 set up and fully restored, but we just did a building expansion. So for our spring show,
we'll probably have 250 set up, but our max is 275, which works well with my numbers because I'm not big on games on ass. I'm big on games on legs, and I think games on ass is a disservice, at least in my opinion, you know, but that's, you know, so I'm trying to set up everything I got is bottom line.
I got you. Sure, go ahead, Cindy.
We do have 52 games, pinball games, at the museum because our space is limited. We only have about 2,000 square feet. But at this point, we have about 130 pinball games, and we rotate things in and out. So we just keep growing.
We do video. We have the vintage arcade. Okay. Again, just to commercialize it because you got to be able to pay the rent. So make sure that, you know, we rounded it off. We have the classic arcade. We have the first Pong, a you know, very hard game to get. You know, the Galaga, that's, you know, the Centipedes, you know, all the classics. So we try to stay on the top tier of all those arcade because, again, the young kids, you know, make a spending decision for the parents. And maybe the pinball's new to them, but they definitely know how to play the arcade games because they play them on their phone. So I think a balance of all that and skee ball, we picked up all the skee balls from El Dorado Arcade in Coney Island about 6 years ago, 17, 18 skee balls from the 50s and 60s, and they're as popular as anything that we have. So I think anyone that's contemplating doing a museum, a vintage arcade, retro arcade, you need to have a well-rounded, commercialized business, in my opinion. Because you have to be able to pay the weight of being at a great location. And whoever's been to our location in Asbury, we're right on the Atlantic Ocean, prime real estate, you know, big money, tons of people want that site. So the landlord, they may love the pinball concept, but they would have 150 tenants willing to pay, probably more than we're willing to pay, but we're a great mix. Because we're the multiplier. They come to us and play pinball for $10 an hour, but then they'll go eat at the restaurant next door and spend $60, $70. So I think you gotta just keep that in your mind that you're running a business here as much as you take it from the hobby to the business, and you have to understand that part of it.
I think that's the problem with all of the museums right now is space and to keep it. I mean, I know that the Pacific Pinball has been trying to get the location for a while now, and I think you guys have secured some stuff. Is that correct? Hand them the mic. Or if you...
Answer that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I want to answer your first question about...
Oh, right.
You asked everybody else.
Right. I forgot to ask you this.
So, because I came from the museum industry and started... When I quit my job at the Exploratorium, I opened up an arcade, and eventually we decided to call it an arcadium because we were really trying to mix being a museum with being an arcade, and then we're moving more towards being a full-on museum. But we got our 501c3 within 2 years of starting, and our basic concept was preservation. Because we didn't, one thing that we were afraid of was nobody was going to preserve any of this stuff, especially the 30s and 40s, and we happened to live close to somebody. I had 70s machines, and Larry had the early wood rails.
40s and 50s and 60s, Gottlieb games primarily. But one thing that really stimulated us to focus on art and science and history, and also just the museum versus an arcade, is the fact that if you go to the Smithsonian, for example, and you want to learn about pinball, because it is a uniquely American phenomenon, right? They should have something to document this unique treasure, I think, in pastime. They have nothing there. They have a Ms. Pac-Man video game and maybe a game or two that are standing up on their legs collecting dust down in a basement. If you go to the Smithsonian, you would expect to see the history, the complete history of pinball from the earliest games to the most modern games, and that's what we're trying to do. Pinball is really sort of the golden carrot, as it were, to get people in the door. What we really want to teach them about is art, science, and history through pinball, and preserve and promote pinball to make sure it's treated with the reverence that it deserves for its past, and also that it's relevant for future generations.
And I think you guys have done that pretty well, because I know you're doing it for the love of the pinball and the experience. Let me get it back.
Oh,
some money? Yeah, yeah. You flew all the way out to Chicago. You're flying all the way back tomorrow, so it's got to be the money. Yeah. But let's ask Clay a few questions. I want you to, do you know how many pins Tim's got?
Yeah, and I've got a little thing. Maybe we should run it. And I've got your picture show, too. Do you guys want to do your picture show, your history?
Whatever you want.
No, it's what you guys want. I've got, the one thing that's missing in this room is Tim Arnold.
Yeah, let's see Tim.
Tim, just, in case you guys don't know, Tim Arnold runs a Pinball Hall of Fame in Las Vegas. Obviously, he was, them and the PPM were at the forefront. They take a totally different approach, these two entities, as it may be. Tim is a quarter drop thing. These guys are basically pay one price. Tim is really a glorified arcade when you come down to it. He's not much of a museum. He doesn't really present the art or the history or anything. I personally really appreciate what Larry and Michael do, more so than, all you guys are doing great things, but I really appreciate what Larry and Michael do, and I would like to give them a presentation. This is a mermaid playfield. It's like the last one known in existence that isn't in a game. And I know you guys have a mermaid, so I want you guys to have this. It's a gift.
Thanks.
You know? So they've got a mermaid. I know Larry just picked up one. So and everyone has a thrash play field, so now
a little better than the one I picked up.
Yeah. So they can
Thanks, Clay.
And no problem.
We told Clay about a show. We're doing a lot of shows. One of them is Pinball Underwater.
And the one machine that we didn't have to put in the Pinball Underwater was Mermaids, because we had a really horrible version of it that just wasn't cutting it. So we asked Clay, and that's fantastic.
You know, Michael, now that means that you have time to put that mermaid playfield in there, so that by the next time Clay is out there, it should be up and in the museum.
Oh, I don't have any fear that they'll get right on that. My situation with the Ann Arbor Pinball Museum is completely different than all these guys' models, and it's for a variety of reasons. I have, a presentation I'll do, but we'll do it at the end. Right now, let's run the Tim Arnold thing, just because... Well, why not? Because Tim is Tim.
And Tim wasn't here, so...
Yeah, and Tim is not here. Let me just see what I did with it. Okay, so he gave me two. Let's look at the first one here. And he did this in the bathroom because it was the only quiet place in all of his museum.
Hey, it's Tim here, coming to you live from the Pinball Hall of Fame in Las Vegas, broadcasting from the bathroom, because that's the only place that's quiet enough for you to hear this. So, you want to open a pinball museum. Clay said I should send along some hints about what you should do and shouldn't do. First of all, you should know what your local laws are, especially on zoning and taxes on amusements, and you should either go to your city or township hall and physically look at the paper copies, or you can go to municode.com and read the regulations. Make sure you know exactly what constitutes an amusement machine, whether it's coin-operated, and what's allowed in your potential zoning. Because you can't even start down the road towards opening a pinball museum unless you have the right zoning. Second of all, you're going to be dealing with a landlord, and he'll be negotiable on everything but the price. The price he's usually got in his mind, this is what my space is worth and this is what I'm going to get. But there's other things you can negotiate on, the length of the lease. And if you're going to sign a lease, if 4 years is what you want, I would try to divide it up into a two-year lease with a two-year option. That way you can bail out at the halfway point, but if things are going well, you can go the full four-year terms. You can also negotiate on the use and who pays for what. Especially be very clear on who fixes major things that could go wrong, like air conditioning, heating, and electric. And again, the landlords are entirely negotiable about everything but price. This is the most important one here. Have very few clear goals and do not deviate. There's a lot of places that try to do a bunch of things really poorly, your goal as a pinball museum is to only do one or two things and try to do them really well. Here at the Pinball Hall of Fame, we don't have a gambling license, we don't have a liquor, we don't have a pizza, we don't have a ball crawl. We've only got two goals here at the Pinball Hall of Fame: to operate a pinball museum open to the public 7 days a week, and to raise money for local social service charities. We don't do anything beyond that, and it frees up a lot of time so we can do our job better with the few things that we do do. Another one, have one person in charge. That's not to mean that you don't take suggestions and that you don't have a management committee or a board of directors, but what will cripple you is if two or three different factions within your organization can't make a decision and something goes horribly wrong because nobody could decide anything. It's actually better to have one Hitler than have a bunch of people arguing endlessly about what you should do. Here's another one. Charge more than you think your product is worth and then discount. If you're doing an admission at the door and you'd like to get $10 to $15, post your price at $20 and then offer discounts. You can always discount later, but you can never raise your prices. Also, as a hobbyist, you tend to downplay what your product is worth. There are other people that will pay you for what you have and what you do. So again, start high and then discount. Here's the most important one: prepare to work long and hard or you do not start. Retail is not for the squeamish. It's a 7-day-a-week thing. You're going to be called at all hours to do things. I would not contemplate thinking that you can be a standoff manager and expect things are going to go well. You're going to have to get in there on a daily basis and spend all your time and all your energy doing it. Here's one that might surprise you. Politicians are your friend. That's right. If you're having problems with a zoning issue or some murky language that you don't understand prior to your opening, get a hold of your county commissioner, your village commissioner, or whoever the politician is for your home or the district where the arcade is going to be located, and you can actually appeal to them for help. And it's not official help. Usually what happens is the politician will make a couple phone calls, and then suddenly your problems will magically disappear. Right now, politicians love the idea of a nostalgia pinball museum. It's artsy. It helps class up their town. So they're really kind of anxious to have you start this kind of a business in their jurisdiction, unlike back in the day when pinball arcades were the devil's tool and they didn't want them in their precious little town. Another one, ancillary revenue streams. We're currently getting about 15% of our revenue here at the Pinball Hall of Fame by what we call the three S's: snacks, shirts, and silly shit. So if you're selling beverages, our number one machine here at the Pinball Hall of Fame is not the latest, newest Stern pinball machine. It's always been and always will be the soda machine. You want to sell as much food as you can. You want to sell souvenirs and knickknacks, and you want to anything else you can think of that adds to your revenue stream, go for it. And last of all, but not least of all, quality draws return visits. Four simple words that will make you succeed. Instead of spending a lot of time on fancy atmospheres and things that don't matter, what you want to have is games that run great, that are brightly lit, and that pay out fairly. People want to occasionally win free games or free balls. They want to have a product that works well every time. So that's my opinions about what you should do if you're going to open a pinball museum. If you have more questions or if you want to talk to me at length, you can get a hold of me at pinballhalloffame@msn.com. Thanks.
Now, in Tim's defense, he is in a unique position. He's in Las Vegas. But he also brings in $20,000 a week. I don't know about you guys, but that's my yearly budget that he takes in 1 week. So you may not agree with everything he says, but he's doing something right.
So let's go back to the panel up here. What else do you guys, out of what Tim put out, what are you guys thinking about, like snacks, food? You guys do that?
We do food. And our food service has been going up phenomenally over the last year because we've done a lot of work in the food department developing menu items that are just going like gangbusters. So for us, the food is just great. We're developing a pizza, you know, that we're selling and is doing very well.
Okay.
Us pinball techs, when we're not fixing pinball machines, we're fixing broken equipment in the food service department, like the pizza ovens and the deep fryers. We have a guy who all he does is polish play fields, clean play fields. Because if you look at if you've been to the place or you look at any of the videos on YouTube or anything, you'll see that our machines are in top shape. And they are played a lot. Our Wizard of Oz has probably got more miles on it than any other Wizard of Oz on the planet. We've got about 20,000 players on the Wizard of Oz and running. So, say again?
Tim said that his Wizard of Oz came to himself about a month ago. So, and I don't know if he's going to make sense
or not, or something like that. Now, we use pay one price. Our business model is pay one price. And everything inside is now free play. The pinball machines are all free. So you can play them all you want, anything you want, and you don't have to worry about which game is the best. You know. So we're not in a position where we have to worry about floor space and whether this pinball machine is producing money or not, and we have to get rid of it if it doesn't produce money. We don't care. Because with pay one price, they come in and they get the whole thing is free, and we don't get concerned about whether one machine's getting played more than another, because it just doesn't matter when you're in no coins. From a technical standpoint, half of the problems with machines in arcades, coin-operated arcades, is coin problems. Coin jams on the coin mechs and so forth. We've eliminated all that. We've eliminated the counting room. We've eliminated having to deal with all the coin and having to make the change and all that. Pay one price is a great, great thing.
And just to point out something, don't let you think that the arcade business is not a viable business, because the arcades are very viable with corporations like Chuck E. Cheese and Dave & Buster's. They make tons and tons of money. I mean, but it's kind of interesting. Chuck E. Cheese is more of, they'll have a pinball machine, but Dave & Buster's, and this is my little thing that I've had a lot of fight with over the last year or two, is that it is a policy by Dave & Buster's not to have a pinball machine in any of their locations. Not.
Now, what is the reason? Why is what's that? The reasoning? Yeah,
they say they're not gain back all its money that is owed. It takes up too much room. It's a technical nightmare. They were a test location here for Stern and Williams back in like the 90s. And when Williams closed up, they chopped it off, and that was it. They just dropped pinball completely.
Can't you change that, Dave?
I am working on that every day. I meet with more VPs, and I'm like, why don't we have pinball? In fact, I'm going to IAPA this year for the first time with Dave & Buster's to take a look and probably steer them to some Stern or some Jersey Jack machines, which would be nice. I mean, everybody else that I know that works there is like, yeah, we want pinball. But it's just, it's an uphill battle. But with you guys, this is why I like pushing out the museums, is because you definitely are giving the aspect that everybody needs.
Now, does Dave & Buster's own or they lease their equipment from operators? They own their equipment.
My personal opinion is you're wasting your time. That Dave & Buster's would present pinball in a poor light. The reason why they don't want it is because it's high maintenance. They got to clean it. They got to do work. I don't even bother. Let these guys who can do pinball right handle it. Dave, forget Dave & Buster's. I mean, what are they going to do? Put one machine in a 20,000 square foot building? How is that going to help? It's not. Yeah, it's just not worth it. Waste of time.
And the problem with Chuck E. Cheese is, unfortunately, is they might have one machine, but it's always a basket case. It's either not working correctly, it's not been cleaned in the last 6 months. It has no passion behind it. And the only reason I was going that way, Clay, is because I'm approaching senior technician at Dave & Buster's, so I'd be training all these technicians to repair and maintain all the pinballs across the U.S. So I'm looking at that aspect, that if I can get a newer aspect of people out there to have a little bit. And the funny thing is, most of the technicians that I deal with love pinball. They all come to my pinball parties. They all come to this. So there's a undermass group that we're trying to build up here to just come in here.
The reason why they don't want to, it's because they know they can't deal with it.
And the best thing is, three of the VPs are all ex-Williams employees, and they worked for Williams Pinball. So there's some problems there.
You know, from an operator standpoint, I in the 70s and 80s, I used to operate machines on the streets. And Pinball machines for the operator are a much better investment to get their money back than video games, because with pinball machines holding their value the way they have been through the 90s, you could buy a pinball machine for $3,500, you know, like a Twilight Zone or something, run it for years, collect money from it, and then sell it at the back end and take your profit at the back end and possibly get your entire investment back, your entire outlay back.
Exactly. We're going to answer up, and we're going to open up to the floor for some questions to the whole panel.
Before we go any further, I'd like to find out about the 501c3 status of the people who haven't answered yet. I know Tim also is a 501c3.
We are not 501c3. We are
not. Not, and
I am a loser ass in the business. So I am not 501c, but I am not anywhere near making a profit. As a matter of fact, I've got a 20-minute presentation, if there's time, I'll show you, and I'll explain to you all the cost elements that I run through and how bad of a business model I am actually using. But you know what? I don't care. That's the point. I really don't care.
Since I brought it up, I should also mention that the American Classic Arcade Museum in New Hampshire is a 501c3, and they have a charitable system in New Hampshire where the closest thing we have to live in-person gambling, which is high-stakes bingo, they have a stream where they get to get some bingo revenue channeled to them. So they have an outside source of revenue, sort of like a guaranteed stream of donations, you might say.
Let's continue on. Anybody else have some questions to the panel? We're going to go over here. This is where I get my exercise. I get to run around. And
hi. One of the things that I haven't heard you talk about, I think Michael might have touched upon it a little bit in the mission of the Pacific Pinball Museum, but I wonder if you could talk about conservation and the choices that you're making when you're preserving these games. And what I mean by that is that what you're, I work for a museum as well, and we actually call these games, many of the games that you guys are talking about, user facts rather than artifacts, because we allow people to play them. Now, some of them we've decided are too fragile or too, we restrict from public play. So I guess it's a two-part thing. Are there any games that are like that for you? And then also, what sort of choices are you making in terms of conservation? Are you, in a kind of short example to use there is, are you always using original parts? Are you fabricating things yourself? How are you actually conserving these?
Were you addressing us or?
I think he's addressing the whole panel. He called you out first.
Okay,
we're going to let you go.
You know, we kind of draw the line at the 30s and 40s machines. We have to make a choice as to whether we let people play them. We have them. It's the first thing you see when you come into the museum. We have a parlor bagatelle hanging on the wall. You can't play that. Start, you know, with Wiffle, and it goes up to the first pre-war game. We will demo those for people, but we don't generally let the public play them. But I am, one thing we're trying to do is maybe make some of those available for play, specifically get some that aren't too precious, like a Bally Bumper, say, you know. And then to answer the second part, we don't have a process. We don't have a policy in place. We want to hook up with somebody that's in museum studies and actually have acquisitions where you bring machines in. We had a great opportunity when we worked with the San Francisco Airport Museum, and I could tell the look on the lady's face when she came into our warehouse is like, you know, this is not a museum, and this is, you know, hey, it's pinball, you know. For one thing I always tell people, it's a coffee table with a plug on it, and that sounds a little rough, but, you know, like you said, they're user, what do you call it, user facts instead of artifacts. But there is a point, you know, like in the early 30s and 40s when you're dealing with, this might be the only one here. We certainly wouldn't let somebody play it. It's there to be studied and preserved and available for research. Not, at that point, it's more valuable as a as an artifact than a user fact. So we don't have a strict policy, so I don't know if that answers your question. We'd like to find out, you know, procedures like from the Smithsonian, but they're not real forthcoming with their info on pinball machines. You were going to say something.
Well, you're saying almost like 30 machines. They made, what, 70,000 World Series? They made like 50,000 Baffle Balls. These things are available inexpensively. They're all over. World Series, there's even parts available for.
Yeah, except when you only have one.
You have more than one.
Right, yeah. And we're working on getting more than one so that it's not like that. Because we want people, we actually let people play the World Series. And I let people play the bumper. But it's behind a rope. You got to ask. It's not the kind of thing where, you got to understand, we have little kids coming in and they'll punch off games. And on a lot of Larry's games, they'll sit there, cook the coil because they don't play the first ball because they don't know to push the ball up. So either you got to have staff there to tell them, and most of the places I know don't even offer those kind of games because of that.
We had them. Same reason. People don't get how to play them. I mean, we have. I got an Army Navy getting restorated. I mean, that's a rarer one than the 50,000, right? The Juggle Ball. I think they made 1,000 of them. I wouldn't put that out just because maybe they made 1,000, but I think there's only 4 or 5 in the world that exist. And just by chance, I also got the operating instructions for it that were on eBay by the luck of God for like $30. Somebody was selling Juggle Ball. So it's a complete game with the marquee. With the stick, the first flipper game. That's probably as rare as they come. So those type of games, I mean, I put them out there maybe with an enclosure or something around it, or maybe play. Yeah, they were. That's what I'm saying. But then they got beat up, and then somebody pulls the plunger out too hard, and you know what? We said, again, when you're commercializing, it is different. You have to make a little break on what? I mean, people say, how do you let people play the E.M. Evil Knievel? Well, most people don't know it is an E.M. Evil Knievel. So they're not playing it as much as you think. But the collectors appreciate it. That's what, you know, we tried to do was put that in. But getting back to the maintenance part, we have a customized bowl we made in China. Now, we should have shared it with the industry, and we should. It took us about 7 or 8 months to customize a bulb that gives you the right pixel. So it's not that, I call it the Chinese Christmas in all due respect, but point, it's not the white light. We matched the pixel of an incandescent bulb up. And for preserving a game, nothing's worse than changing a light bulb every 6 months. The back glasses will burn and flake. You're going to, you know, the sockets of the bulbs, as Jim could say in the beginning, we'd had bulbs, I mean, it was a constant maintenance issue. So we went to the LED bulbs, indistinguishable, because I think you even fought me on it in the beginning. You know, we always have a debate, and I, you know, like I say, I don't care who's right, I care what's right.
It took us time to figure out which bulb.
So eventually, the color right. We got the right bulb customized in China, you know, supposedly exclusive. But point is, we'll put that out to the industry. I think our website has them, but they are unbelievable bulbs for pinball, because your back glasses will flake with the hot and the cold. In New Jersey, gets cold in the winter. Not that you keep the heat on, but you're still going to have that fluctuation at night. In the summertime, it can get hot to cold, cold to hot. So on the preservation part is, you know, we keep all the games waxed. I mean, we are, you know, diligent in waxing the ball, changing the balls, keeping all the dirt away. You know, we vacuum the games out when they come in to keep all the dirt from underneath the play field from moving around as games get moved. And if they're on their backs, all that dirt will go onto the gears and whatnot. So we try to minimize the mistakes that we cause on the games.
Now, there are a bunch of other mechanical things that I can do to the machines to preserve them as well. One of the things we do is wherever the game calls for a 15 AGC fuse, I've called the boys put 10 in. AGC fuses in them. They run just fine, and it'll save us on coils, because when the coil starts to cook or something, it'll generally blow the fuse before you blow the coil if you're using tens. All right, another thing that we do is on all the critical motors, like pitch and bat motors and so forth, the pitch motors, which are so hard to get and find parts for, We've added fuse sockets to those motor circuits and put in 1-amp slow blow fuses so that if the pitch motor gets jammed, instead of burning out the motor, you'll pop the fuse. I'd much rather change a fuse than have to change out a motor.
Yeah, we're doing something similar on the EMs too, except we're even going down further. We're running 5-amp slow blows on the coils now for all the EMs.
It
actually works fine. But slow blows, not fast blows. Slow blows, 5-amp slow blows. And then that way, if a coil locks on, it's 10 seconds and then it blows and then you don't smoke a coil. And we're using LEDs too. I didn't have custom made ones. I've been actually using Terry's at Pinball Life's. He has a single LED frosted warm white. It's got to be warm white. Don't get the cool white. Cool whites look.
No, cool whites make it way too.
Yeah, it makes it look like it's an LED. And, I want people to walk up to the game and say, boy, that's a nice game. Not to walk up and say, boy, it's got LEDs in it. But we found, as Tim is running all LEDs. He's cut his electric bill like in half.
Yeah.
And I didn't believe him at first until we started doing it. And I've noticed a dramatic decrease in our electric bill. And also, like he was saying on the back glasses too, it's just not worth the risk from the heat of the light bulbs. And it's a constant maintenance thing, like somebody else was saying. Yeah, I call it chasing light bulbs. It's a full-time fucking job, chasing burnout light bulbs. I'm sick of it. I'm just sick of it. I want to put a game in and not have to touch it again, unless it needs a flipper rebuild or something. But changing light bulbs is just a drag. But on the downside of it, certain games on the lower half of the GI in the playfield, we have to use light bulbs. I have a couple guys that are very sensitive to the light coming from LEDs. And what happens is on certain positions of light bulbs, as the ball rolls, it catches the reflection of the LEDs and does something freaky to this epileptic-type guys. And so I've got a couple guys that got to run every one of my games that have LEDs in it, and sometimes I have to back the LEDs off, on the lower part of the playfield closest to the player, because everybody is different. Some people, LEDs don't bother. Some people just freak out from them. Even if done right, they still freak out with them. So, it's a very tight balance that you have to run.
And as far as other parts are concerned, we are using all original Gottlieb parts for Gottlieb games, Williams for Williams, and so forth. To tweak up the action of our games, we have been unwinding coils, taking about 100 turns off a coil on the top bumpers and so forth to try to make them faster.
To make the 60 games play, and we pitch them better. Pitch them a little higher so they're faster, We try to make every game is a minute or to 3 minutes of entertainment. So I'm always the text and say, hey, these games got to play fast. The 60s games, they don't have to play dumpy. If you unwind the coils, you go to high tap, number one, unwind the coils, and pitch the backup to the max. We're at 3 inches on the pitch. That ball's coming down, and it's fast. It's not a slow game where the ball's floating around the play field. So that's something that we always push was gameplay, that they're exciting. Regardless of what the standard pitch is, if you see the new games, they're pitched faster too. The ball comes down faster. So Jim said, by unwinding the coils, Bob Borden in Pennsylvania, he taught me that trick when I played his games from the 50s. They were playing like rocket ships. And I couldn't believe it. I go, wow, these are not slow games. They're as fast as the new games. So that was something that I think makes those 60s games a little more palatable for the people that want a faster gameplay.
Now, what's important is to make sure that any location you choose has sufficient electricity. All right, when I was designing the electrical system for the Silver Ball, I limited it to 4 games per dedicated 20-amp circuit, no more than 4 games. That way, there's enough power for those games to run. We've never had any electrical issues at the Silver Ball in terms of slow play because you're pulling down on the electric. All right.
We've got 1,200 amps coming into the VFW Museum. So I've got like a bazillion circuits. But we run 8 games on a 20-amp circuit and without any issue. But we got, full 1,200 amps coming in, not like a 200-amp breaker panel. We've got that times six.
Well, if you're running EMs, because they only draw about 2 amps per piece,
yeah.
You're okay with that, but the dot matrix games are rated at 8 amps a game.
No, we've measured them. They're at, if you're using LEDs, they're 2 amps too. You know, and if you're not using LEDs, they're about 2.5.
Yeah.
So, you know, and on the angle thing, we're doing that too. Ours are all jacked up too, because I want and 3-ball. Anything that's got 3-inch flippers is 3 balls. I don't care what it is. If it's got 3-inch flippers, it's 3 balls. You know, there, I don't think I have any except, well, maybe I have a couple exceptions. 2-inch flippers, it's 5 balls. That's what we do, because we want to keep game times down too. Not just because today's society is short attention span. It's like unbelievable. People are just, you know, they can't think on one thing for 3 minutes. You know, they just have a problem. So we try and do that. On the newer games, you know, we don't widen the out lanes or do any of that kind of goofy stuff. But, boy, I'd sure like to, but people would really complain, you know, on the newer stuff, you know, some, especially the Williams stuff that they can play for 20 minutes.
What these guys are saying is true, because I played some EM games in the hall last night, and I thought, these are either, you know, upsized coils or high-tapped or something, and these games played as good as any of the new games, and there's a lot to those older games. Don't, you know, sell those old games short, because those games were designed when guys really put their heart and soul into those games.
So just to tie it up, so we have Seattle covered. We have San Francisco? Is that
close enough?
Covered. We have Las Vegas covered. We have New Jersey. We have Ann Arbor, Michigan. So who knows? We might have something in, like, Florida soon, so that we can have some place to go in the winter months to go play pinball. But, oh, we have somebody over here. You got something in Florida?
No. I'm just curious how many people in this room are fantasizing about opening a museum.
Good question. Anybody here thinking about opening a museum? I opened an arcade, but that's another story. Oh, we got one.
These cannibals.
See a good shrink.
You think about opening a museum? Whereabouts?
New Ulm, Minnesota. It's a smaller town, about 15,000. I've already bought a building and stuck about $200,000 into it, and 150 games. Only have about 2,000 square foot area for actually showing and playing. I've got 1,000 square foot in for a wood shop, and I have another 3,000 square foot for repair, maintenance, restoration, do chrome plating, powder coating, and just for ourselves.
Okay. Sounds like it.
Is your name John?
Yes. We met,
yeah.
You do all your own in-house chrome plating and powder coating, all the stuff's in-house, huh? That's great.
Oh, I got a great insurance story. I don't know how you guys handle insurance, but I just went through it. We had originally insurance for just a warehouse, because that's kind of like how we started, was a warehouse. And I kind of, when we opened the museum, I went into my insurance agent and I said, you know, I got this museum. It's limited access. You know, we're not open to the public, you know, but a few times a year. But, you know, what do you think? And they're like, we'll just move your coverage from place A to place B. So I let it ride, and then they did some research on me a few months later and were like, wait a minute, you're not a warehouse anymore. You know, they saw pictures and stuff like that. So, you know, my insurance went from $800 a year to like $2,500 a year, you know, because they, well, that's probably nothing compared to what you guys pay. But,
$1,000 a month.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, they're, yeah, you know, now Tim, on the other hand, has no insurance, none. He's self-insured. So what Tim has done is he's put $900,000 into a separate bank account,
That's his insurance policy, if something happens. Tim does not believe in insurance. I kind of don't believe in it either, but I'm a little more scared than Tim, you know. But he is what's known as self-insured. And if, you know, like in my case, I own the building, so I could do the same. Tim owns the building. You know, we could both, I could do what he could do. I mean, my balls aren't big enough. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's you know, the things that can go wrong are unbelievable. We also have host liquor liability. Do you guys have that? Anybody have that? You know, because if somebody walks in with a beer and something bad happens and you don't have that, you're in trouble. So now what the host means is that you're not selling or serving, that they've magically brought their own in or whatever. But and if you get in trouble, you're still kind of covered. So it's another thing to look for.
Go ahead, Larry. All right, Michael.
Insurance thing.
Want to hand the mic up? Thanks.
Because we were hit up with some pretty heavy insurance requirements because we were dealing with the Naval Air Station. So the Navy had this incredible requirement. And where we were had some heavy-duty requirements. It was costing quite a bit. My wife looked into it and found this place, which I would recommend to everybody. It's the Antiques and Collectibles Association. And when you join them, they are a group, so they get the group insurance, and it's much more affordable. They basically, you know, you're considered an antique and collectible if you're dealing with pinball machines, and they will let you join their group, and once you join the group, you can get the insurance, and it's really the way to go.
Mike?
What's the rating? Are they AAA rated? You don't want to fly by night? No, I believe we get our insurance from, they're top-notch. I think we get Lloyd's of London coverage. Yeah, they have liability. I'm sure they do. It's just I don't. Unfortunately, I don't have to deal with that end of it. I just know that we, you know, up until when we found them, we were paying quite a bit, and they made it affordable for, you know, like if you're insuring your collection. I'm sorry, Dave.
No, I was just going to say, Michael, I didn't think you were an antique at this standard. I don't know why your wife is already thinking that you're that old to be considered an antique.
Well, you know, it's funny. We got visited by Antiques?
Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah.
Antiques Roadshow. I've been waiting to see something about that.
Yeah, and so they shot a little bit, and it was kind of funny. So the guy comes on, and he goes, well, can you tell us a little bit? So I'm starting to tell him about Bally Bumper, you know, and how we got one that was confiscated by the Oakland cops. He's going, well, no, I was more interested in like Adam's Family or Twilight Zone. And I said, I thought this was Antiques and, you know, Roadshow. And he goes, oh, well, yeah, this is more like collectibles end of it, you know. So, when they were looking at it, because the show is geared more towards people who buy and sell these things. And I think which kind of surprised me, even to them, these older pinball machines aren't very valuable. They're looking at the, you know, Medieval Madness and those kind of machines as the high, you know, the
high
money.
Dollar items, and it's not
they're,
because
they're
of
looking
that.
At eBay and seeing Medieval Madness going for $16,000 and Bally Bumper going for $200.
Yeah.
You know, the old 30s vintage machines just don't carry that much value with the collectors because they're just not fun to play compared with the new machines.
Except
you know, face
when,
it.
Except when you try to buy one from somebody who thinks that
they're... Oh, yeah. Right, yeah, yeah. they probably watched Pawn Stars, and they think they have a Bally Odds and Evens worth about $4,000. You know,
yeah. I saw that show.
Yeah.
I mean, we all seen that show.
Yeah.
I know Clay and I, but it's kind of funny. Clay has a site. We all know the Pinball Ninja. Yeah. But it was funny. The day he wrote, had a little article about the museum piece, Gas Attack. Do you remember those? I was doing the same one in Buffalo, two machines. So they have, like, I guess, six or seven machines, three different tours of machines that go around. I had two. You had three you were working on. So, I mean, so even in museums, there is something that's close to a pinball that's going out for the kids to play, and those things get beat.
Yeah, I actually worked on that machine.
Capcom Breakshot.
Yeah, it's part of a. It's the most popular exhibit ever made. It's called Grossology.
Grossology.
And that's the business that I used to be in, which is building science exhibits. They built two of those, or three of them, I think.
No, seven.
Oh, seven.
They got three in another tour, and then two in a smaller exhibit that goes around. The neat thing about it is Pat Lawler is the one who made those games for him.
Pat Lawler, PLD.
Yeah, and you know when you open them up, they all got all Stern hardware in them.
Well, they started out with Capcom great shots, and they had Capcom hardware, and then so many converted it to Stern.
Yeah.
And I don't know who did that. They were using Capcom. So many did.
Yeah, I actually called. The White Star system. I went in with my stuff to fix it, and it was Capcom stuff, and I'm like, okay, it's Capcom. No, who put all this stuff in? So I called Stern, and they let the cat out of the bag. It was Pat. He had done the whole conversions under PLD. So, unfortunately, we're out of time already, folks. So I'd like to thank our panel for coming from all over to talk to us about museums. So if you would join me in a round of applause for our panel.